Welcome to Sacred Cheese of Life. This is Emma. This is episode 34, What You See Is What You Get, or WYSIWYG, which is a reference to a writing crime, a writing crime that people commit often when they're first starting out. And I read a book this past Friday that did it a lot, even though it's by an amazing author, one of whose books I've covered on this podcast. But I'm not going to name it. If you know it, you'll recognize it. But I don't like to name names when I find problems with things. So there are many things about this book I adored. Okay, it's about it's about a wealthy family in Scotland that has friends who are travelers. Okay, and the travelers are like itinerant, migrant people who live in, you know, caravans and travel around. They don't have fixed homes. They're not homeless, but they're migrants. They're itinerant. They're, what's the other word for that? I don't remember. So the whole book is about racism against travelers and how that's bad. Yes, this is why I had a problem with it. I obviously don't have a problem with being against racism. I have a problem with writing a thing in such a way that it's like hammering you on the head. And I wish I could read you some of these scenes because they're just like, some bad people are mean to travelers. And we watch that and we're like, oh, those people are bad. And then our good people are like, we're not like that. We're friends with them. See what I mean? Like it's over and over and over, and maybe it's meant to be educational. Hold on. But it's not educational programming. It's a novel. It should be telling a story. And it gets so wrapped up in this, like setting up these scenes that are so like a grade school skit on bullying or something. Like, this is, look at this thing that happens. It's bad. Oh, you watch it and you're like, oh, I don't want to do that. That's bad. I want to be the good person and not the bad person. Like, again, nothing wrong with the content, but like telling a story that way is really problematic. It's really problematic because we don't just want to be preached at. We want to be a participant. And that's why What You See Is What You Get is a problem in prose fiction especially. And there's a whole other side of this in filmed genres that are, they have a different issue with that, but I'll get to that if I remember. In prose, we don't want that because part of the point of prose is we interpret. So we want to be like, okay, is Micah lying? Is Micah telling the truth? We want to play a part. We want to be part of it. We don't just read prose for information. We're not reading it to find out whether Hamlet makes it to the end, you know? We're reading it because we want to be part of the interesting questions, like, is the ghost real or is Hamlet insane? What should Hamlet do? Should he kill his uncle? Should he not kill his uncle? Should you do what a ghost tells you to do? Or does that make you a crazy person? Like, there's a lot of things you get to decide when you're watching Hamlet that are not just like, and then this happens, and then that happens, and then we're not reading for the facts. And so that's why when you're writing prose fiction and you start giving facts, like part of it is like, we know racism is bad. Like, we're from here. We get it. We know this. And anybody who doesn't agree with that is not reading the book, because the book is specifically about that and about how it's bad, right? So you're just preaching to the converted, which is actually how most preaching happens. Most people are actually preaching to the converted. Like, doesn't it happen like in church? Those people are already there. So yes, most preaching is to the converted. So, but then what are you doing? Just like being self-congratulatory? We would never be bad like the bad people. We're the good people. Yeah, I read this book ages ago because I adore one of the author's other books. And so I was like, give me more, and read everything by her that I could. And the other ones are great, but this one, it has that big problem. It has the preachy problem. And it also, every time that's going on, the plot dies. There is no plot when that's happening because it's just a morality play, and we don't need a morality play. We really don't need a morality play. We've kind of got this. I think you can generally trust that people know what they think and have made their decisions based on whatever they make their decisions on and don't need to be lectured by us, right? Like, I have a lot of trouble with this on the internet where everyone's always laying down the law. Stop posting this sort of thing because blah, 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 blah. Like, okay, why are you lecturing me? Stop it. I get really annoyed with that and will avoid, by which I mean eradicate those people from my online narrative because boy, do I not like getting preached at. I've already got my ideas and my decisions, and sometimes it can be interesting to sort of hash it out, but like the discourse is exhausting and I do not want it. You go to town and do whatever you want to do, but I don't want it. I don't want it. I don't want to see people arguing through whether bees are enslaved again. These stupid arguments that just go back and forth and back and forth, and like so much ignorance and so much just abject cluelessness is involved. Anyway, this is what that book is like in a lot of ways. Now, in other ways, it's absolutely wonderful because the story it's telling is about a theft. And it's a theft of some things from this. The wealthy family's getting broken up because the patriarch died and they had to sell off different parts of the land to pay for his chemo or whatever. But he died and now they have to give up their castle, which, okay, you're also never going to make anybody feel sorry for somebody who's losing their castle. Okay, like there's just some levels of cluelessness in this book that are astonishing to me because there had to be people involved, editors, agents, etc. We're supposed to feel sorry for this girl from this incredibly wealthy family. Like, they have to give up this castle, so they're going to go live in their other castle. I do have trouble. Like, yeah, it's sad you're losing your beloved house, but like, and this is something one of the traveler girls says, is like, you know, basically cry me a river. Like, you got things and you got stuff. And like, she even says, oh, has she ever gone hungry about their mom? Because she's like, well, my mom is really sad because, and she's like, yeah, has she ever gone hungry? Has she ever gotten, you know, like she's too cold and she can't get warm. Like, they're really super privileged. And it's also a mistake to try to evoke too much sympathy for people from who are incredibly privileged talking to people who are incredibly unprivileged. Like, she sets up this dynamic, really, really rich people, really, really poor people, we can be friends. And I don't mean to keep repeating this, but the preaching is just like, stop it. I hope I never do this in my writing. And now I'm feeling very self-conscious and wondering whether I do. I really hope I don't. I hope I don't, but who knows? Tell me at sacredcheesepodcast@gmail.com. If you have ever read my books and you found anything preachy, please tell me. I will go fix it and upload new versions to Amazon today if that happened, because I really dislike it. I really dislike it. I was also trying to think whether I ever do any WYSIWYG, which is just like that embarrassing flat thing where characters are trotted out like cardboard cutouts, like little puppets on sticks, you know, like flat pieces of paper held up on popsicle sticks behind a curtain above the top of it. And they go, doink, 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 like acting out a scene that is just for the purpose of a purpose and not anything of themselves and not telling a story and just like act like going through the motions of this scene. Like, I hate that. There were also a lot of long histrionic speeches about where somebody would just say the thing. They would just say the thing that they're thinking about this social issue. Like, I hate those people. They're all look like this and like that, and they do this and they do that. They should all be killed and gotten rid of and thrown in the ocean or whatever. Like, okay, we know you think that. We don't have to have literally 3/4 of a page where they yell that. Like, how many of us... Oh, there's only me. Skipped most of that, because it started and I was like, ugh, eye roll, and skipped to the end, because we know you don't need a whole epic speech to have someone say a thing that makes us know that they're racist or shallow or whatever. We can often get that across in a very short thing, preferably, you know, an action, something they do. That would be better. So the other, yeah, and I was going to talk about the visual aspect of this. So this is something I was taught to do by bad screenwriting teachers. They said, only put on the page what you can actually see, and only make it all, like, they basically told me to do that. They told me to do what you see is what you get, which is the worst advice I've ever heard. And I had to be told this by a TV writer friend, like, yeah, this is really what you see is what you get. And I'm like, what? I was told to do that. I'm doing it right. I'm doing what I was taught in school. Yeah, you were taught wrong. You were taught wrong. And so don't do that. So if you're writing a scene, you want people to say things. Yes. Otherwise, it's a silent film. But they can't just walk in and go, hi, I'm really glad to see you because I have this book I wanted to give you. And the book means a lot to me because it reminded me of you. And it reminded me of that summer that we spent together when we were 14 and we read Up in the Treehouse all the time. And this house we're in right now reminds me of that treehouse. Oh, no. Like, don't do that. Why not, though? Like, why not? And that's, if I had a class right here, I would get people to tell me why not. See, I have these habits. Why not? Because you've left nothing for the audience to do, the reader or the viewer. You've left nothing for them. What are they, just passive recipients of fiction? They're not. They're participants. And so you want to do it sideways, or you want to do it cleverly, or you want to do it subtly, or you want to do it in such a way that it's not straightforward and obvious like that, because it's so boring. It's so boring. And you've all seen bad TV or bad movies or read bad books where people do this, where everyone goes around and they all say exactly what they think and nobody's ever confused and nobody's ever wrong and nobody's ever, like, lying or being sneaky or being a jerk face or whatever. Like, it's so much more interesting. And this is there's a John Rogers thing you should take about this, which is, he said, always have people deliver exposition with attitude. So it's never just like someone walks in and goes, there's a fire truck out front. Someone walks in and goes, the fire truck out front is ruining my recording. It's making me so mad. Like, you wouldn't even say it's making me so mad. We know that. See, it's such an easy bad habit to fall into. There's a fire truck out front. How do you deliver that? And there used to be an exercise I would have students do where I'd be like, come up with as many ways to say I love you as you can without using those words. Don't have them say any of those things like, I think you're awesome, or like, have somebody say it without saying it. And there's so many good ways. Like, there's just a million ways. Or somebody indicating they like somebody without using those words could be like, hey, do you want to go get some coffee? Do you see how that's immediately so much better? If someone walks up to you and says, hey, I really like you, what do you do? Like, it's so, like, you're put on the spot and whatnot. Whereas even if you do like that person, you're going to be awkward about that. We just are not comfortable with that kind of directness. And so, yeah, the, hey, do you want to go get some coffee was one of my favorites. Like, it's a straightforward thing. We know what they mean. Nobody's confused. It's not like, we need to talk. Oh, no. We need to talk is problematic, isn't it? For a lot of reasons. It always means we need to talk in a bad way. It's never like, hey, we need to talk. Like, even that with tone, you can't. I'd still be nervous. Like, why? We are talking. Why can't we just say it now? Why do we need to have a conversation about having a conversation and put it off? Well, it raises tension. But other than that, why would we? Why do we need to, why do you have to talk about talking? Visually, yes, you want people doing something that shows this. And this whole book I was reading, I kept thinking how it would be so much better if you just like took a pen and went whoosh, crossed off that page and had somebody do something small and mean and simple and just cruel. And it never was like that. Like, the whole book was like a draft because it all needed to be rewritten down to Like, make it something clever and visual and awesome and action-based, and it's infinitely better. I'm not really against dialogue. I like dialogue. But dialogue can't just be like a foghorn of information coming out of your mouth. It's so boring. This is what I'm like. Oh, yeah? Well, this is what I'm like. Well, I don't like how you're like. Well, I don't like what you're like either. Well, okay, well, we have to agree to disagree. Okay, fine. Like, come on. And even the action really got to me. There's a villain character. He's a villain. He's the water bailiff, which is, I don't know. He's in charge of the waterways and goes around beating up the traveler kids for doing nothing, like hitting them with this giant heavy stick and hurting them because they're like, I don't know, he's defensive and protective and wicked racist, even though they're all one race. But still, it's racism, I suppose. It's classism, it's not socialism. It's social class hatred or something. But they're all a bunch of white people, but he still is like, these ones are bad, which people always manage to do somehow. So he's horrible, and he's horrible the whole time, and there's nothing interesting about that. Like, it's like putting the gun in the drawer and then, like, taking the gun out of the drawer. It's even less interesting than that. The gun is on the mantelpiece, and the whole time you're like, is that the gun on the mantelpiece? What are they going to do with the gun on the mantelpiece? It's probably going to be a gun, huh? And then later it's a gun, and you're like, wow. So that was a gun, huh? So what you see is really what you get in this book. Oh, man. So he's horrible. He has no depth as a character at all. Honestly, nobody does. Nobody does in the book. And that, again, I think is what you see is what you get. Like, you're like, here is Eris. Here is her brother. Here is her other brother, who is the one who inherits. He's nice. He likes the nice woman who's kind of racist. This is the only one who gets any layers, is the woman, the librarian, who has some sort of genetic thing going on. I don't quite know what. Looks strange, can't hear, uses an ear trumpet. And he really likes her. And then at the end is like, I'm marrying her. And everyone's like, what? So he's straightforward, like somebody damages his stuff, he loses his mind and starts yelling. Okay, that's not interesting. It's not interesting. The heiress girl never learns anything. She starts off being nice to the travelers and ends being nice to the travelers. She figures out who did it, but she does it by like, it's also I don't even want to say chapter book, like middle grade chapter book, because I've read some really subtle and intricate and layered middle grade chapter books that have so much depth and glory to them. And one I might talk about later is The Almost Year. I can't remember. Florence Randall, I think, wrote it. It's so good. It's about, I think I mentioned it before, about a young black girl who gets sent to live with a wealthy white family. I guess she's not wealthy. I think her mom is actually a maid, and she gets sent to live with them because her mom is sick. It's possible her mom worked for them. I can't quite remember. I'll have to read it again. And there's a lot of unconsidered privilege, which is a fascinating topic. This is why it resonates with this book. A lot of racism, unconsidered privilege, and just like being bullheaded about your own stupidity and defending it, which I also find kind of interesting because we all do that in various ways. So that's a book I might read next. But anyway, that has so much more nuance in it than this. And this is an adult book. It's just nobody grows and changes. The bad guys are the bad guys. And the mystery is interesting. And there's this cool twist involving a Bronze Age or an Iron Age, I guess. Iron Age boat, log boat, and a bog body, and it's all cool. There's a lot of cool stuff going on. And the topic is fascinating. Like, I learned all this stuff, but yeah, there was just not, I wanted arc, I wanted story, I wanted character layers, and I did not get them. Like, and there was some really weird stuff that I think a more considered draft would have removed, because like, the main character is kissing everybody. She kisses everybody. Everybody. Like, okay, let's see if I can remember who all she kisses. She kisses this girl who mistakes her for a traveler boy. and who's like flirting with her. And then when she kisses the girl slaps her, like knocks her in the face, hits her in the face, and then jumps on a bus and runs away. And that's supposed to be like, look how, you know, you can't be, you can't take offense when people beat on you because you're the lower class and you can't see. It's all these like cardboard lessons that are just like, stop it. Who else does she kiss? She kisses the girl she's with, the traveler girl. She's in love with the traveler girl. They kiss a lot, a lot. She kisses this guy who's working in their house, who's like the project manager for reconfiguring their mansion, their castle that they're losing. It's turning into a school. And they're there, I guess, still while the work is going on. All of them living in one room, like six of them or something, while the work is going on because they're closing up the estate, I guess. It does not actually make sense why they would be living in this house while all this work is going on. Because presumably they don't own it anymore. So why are they there? But it's just one of many things that don't make sense. What else? Who else does she kiss? She kisses this drag performer, and she sees this guy singing, and she's like, and the traveler girl's like, oh, she's beautiful. And our character's like, that's a man. She's like, what? No, it isn't. How do you know? How do you know? And she's like, I just know. I always can figure things out. Because everyone just says everything straight out in this book. Everyone just says it. So then they're at the bar and she tricks him by saying something in French, which has gendered nouns. Like, are you French? She says. And he says, like, yeah. Only he has to use a masculine ending. You know what I mean? Which he doesn't have to, but he does. So I guess he's letting her know that she guest or something. I don't know. Kisses that guy at the bar. And everyone around is like, woo, because he's dressed as a woman. Okay, who else does she kiss? She kisses the horrible water bailiff guy because he has trapped her friend, the traveler girl, against a standing stone. It's all like this. It's really, it is. It's all like this. It's like, it's almost like fan fiction or something. Like it's, anyway, he's trapped her and he's like, I don't know what he's doing because she says she can't see where his hands are. And we're like, honey, if you can't see, what you're saying is we know where his hands are. Okay. But he's got the stick up against her neck and he's got her trapped and he's hurting her and stuff. And our girl goes up and like, she says, she kisses him. And then she's like, you know, you ever hurt her again, I'll say you raped me and they'll believe it because it's me. And I'm like, you could have done that without kissing the guy. There's no earthly reason. There's no reason she has to kiss every freaking buddy. She kisses everybody. And I don't understand why, because it's just like, what are you doing? And it's so like, most of the book is like, okay, we get it. You're hammering me over the head. And what is this? What is this part about? Is this like, she likes boys and girls? Okay, that's fine. We could have gotten that from like two scenes. I don't know why it had to be the whole book long and all these wildly inappropriate people. All right, a lot of things bugged me about this book. I'm sorry. There were some other things that really startled me, like the girls, the traveler boy. There's I think they're twins, girl and boy, and she's in love with the girl. Of course she kisses the boy too, naturally, at the end. And he's suddenly described as like 6'4". And I'm like, wait, what? I thought he was a kid. From the beginning, he was described as a kid. Somehow, in some way, that made me think he was a child. He's not a child. He's a grown-up man. That was done poorly because really, we should be able to know that. We should be able to know the age of a person without being startled by them being 6'4" at the end. There's a thing that happens when you want to tell a story but you're not sure how, where you can get really tangled up. And I think maybe that's what happened here. Like, there's obviously a great topic to talk about. Like, I want to write about travelers in Scotland and how they're actually awesome and not garbage. Okay, good. I think you can safely assume most people get that already, that they're not whatever. So we could just start there. Do you know what I mean? Like, we don't have to go, here's the thing people think, and here's why it's bad. Like, we can just skip to the end of that. Here's some awesome characters. And then we'll know they're awesome, and we don't have to have the whole A plus B. Like, you don't have to show your work. You don't have to explain it by showing every step of the way. Here's your prejudice. Here's how they get hateful treatment. Here's how that hateful treatment hurts them. Here's how awesome they actually are. Like, I think you can really skip to that ending. And I think this is actually the case in a lot of good representation of oppressed groups. Like, we just show how awesome they are and then move on. Like, you don't have to do the whole thing necessarily, although I guess a lot of times they do. But it's almost like torture porn or something like that when you do that. Like, why are we sitting here watching these horrible things happen? We don't need to see that. And all the time she spends not showing us the good things happening, she's showing us the bad things happening. Like, can't you just, I don't know. I'm not sure it works. I know it doesn't work. I'm not sure what the purpose of it is, though. Like, I can hear, and I listen to a lot of My Favorite Murder. I can hear about a bad thing happening without needing to hear every detail and spend all this time going in. And they're the same way. They don't want the gory detail. They know, right? Like, we get it. You can just say, he dismembered, whatever. Like, we don't need to hear every little thing and, like, get into the, because once you start doing that, you're being gross about it. And there's a level at which this is what's happening here. Like, it's almost fetishizing the torture these poor people go through and how they're treated and how bad it is. Like, we can just sort of know it. We don't have to see all the awfulness along the way. And my very favorite parts of the time with the traveler family is, like, the main character and her brother go and spend the night there. They hang out. And of course, our girl is in bed with the traveler girl and kissing and all this. I'm like, okay. It's not a relationship that's ever going anywhere. So I'm not sure why it's there. Like, see, it also feels exploitative because it's like, hi, I'm super privileged and wealthy and can threaten even the powerful water bailiff guy just with my words. And so I'm going to come into your home and we're going to get snuggly. And like, the power differential is so bad that it's really uncomfortable to me anyway. And I know the other girl was into it too, but like, once there's a huge power differential like that, it's really iffy. It's really iffy. And there's also something really like, look how good our girl is that she's like this with her, you know, like, it's yucky. It's yucky. Ew. So yeah, I'm hard to please. Like, I don't want to see them being bad. I don't want to see them being good. I don't know. Can't people be treated like people without being lionized or vilified or trotted through their paces of, I'm a good one of them. I'm a bad one of these. I'm one of those. I'm like, people are people who make choices, as far as I can tell. And that's enough. That's enough. Like, I'm not sure what the goal is with this kind of fetishizing representation of pain and suffering of the oppressed. Like, I know we need it to a certain extent if we don't know about it, but I'm also not sure. I am sure. I'm sure this isn't the way to go about it. Partly because the main character is so clueless. She's so clueless, she doesn't get stuff, which is a good way to go about introducing an unfamiliar situation. Like, we've seen that in other texts where we enter into the world of whatever with our person who's new to that world, which makes it a lot easier to explain stuff or have us learn about stuff without having it be explainy and reading the manual. You know, we don't want to read the manual. We don't want world building sitting there like blah di da di da, telling us all about the setting and blah, blah, blah. And when someone's new, you can do it by having them enter that world. And I know every author knows this, that's a really good way to go because it makes it sort of seamless and unnoticeable, which, yes, that's a good thing. Like, do it like that. Do all the things like that instead of all this, like, banging us on the head with it like they do all through this book. Yeah. What you see is what you get. So the point about that term, the reason I picked it, is A lot of the book is like that. Like, it's a scene that just means what it means. It means exactly what it says. There's no depth to it. There's no extra to it. There's no interpretation involved or allowed. Like, it's not like, oh, this is a story about a privileged person who thinks she's so awesome and she's not. No, there's none of that. She thinks she's awesome and she's awesome. It's all one level. Like, there's no room for interpretation, really, or analysis or wiggling around at all. It's what people complain about young adult, when actually young adult has a lot more of that in it, usually. I want layers. I want layers. I want to be able to look at a character behaving a certain way and think, okay, I wonder if that's a good thing or a bad thing that's going on there. I wonder if they're aware of them, of their own privilege. I wonder if they're aware that they're being just as racist by focusing on these people and treating them in a certain way as the bad people who treat them badly are. Like, there's no awareness of that, and there's no levels to read it with. And that's so upsetting, because it's like the scene in the TV show or whatever, where you don't want someone just walking in and going, I really like you, so I brought you chocolate. Like, okay. There's a reason that TV often has people yelling at each other when they really like each other, and it's because it's embarrassing and flat and boring, and there's nothing to it when people just say what they think. It's so weird. If you ever see a scene where people start doing that and they're yelling, it's because that's the only way to do it without being ridiculous. And the yelling is also cliched and ridiculous at this point. But at least it's less like, here is a fish. Why is it a fish? Here is a fish. I don't know. If someone likes you and gives you a fish, I'd be much more interested in that scene than if they gave you chocolates. Why? Because it's more interesting. Because maybe they went out and caught that fish themselves. Maybe they know you love fish and you never get fish. I don't know. Make it a fish. A fish is more interesting. At least I'm getting excited about the fish, whereas the chocolate was like, oh gosh. All right. Chocolate. Oh, time to bark. Time to bark. It is time to bark. When something is on the nose, it just means there's no subtlety, there's no artistry, there's no levels, there's no layers. You're just saying exactly what the thing is, and you're showing exactly what the thing is. And we don't like it because it's boring and bad and weak and feeble. It's not good. We want it to show some artistry. It's like, yes, you can take a photograph of a tree and there's a tree. But if you paint the tree, you're going to show, I'm looking at a lot of trees, you're going to show the tree through your own eyes, and it's going to have that flair to it and that flavor to it and that twist and your own angle and your own thing about white pines. If I were going to paint a white pine, you know, it would probably be looming over me. I'm staring at white pines. It would probably be giant and scary and looming over me, because I live in a house under these giant, scary, looming white pines, and I have white pine fear because of the day like 7 of them fell last December. I was scared before that, but they all went down with this unholy crash, and it was the most frightening thing. And these are so close, like I'm looking out my window, I can't see the tops. They're really close, and they're really big, and they're really tall. So like, that would be in it if I painted a white pine, you know? Whereas if I just take a picture of a white pine, you're like, that's a tree. And that's kind of what this book did the whole time. Here's a tree. This is a tree. This one's a tree. This one's also a tree. And the mystery of it was pretty cool. The mystery that gets solved at the end. But all of the like declaiming of their exact emotions. Wow. Like, I was going to say singing your aria. But arias aren't even usually that on the nose. What is on the nose like that? Nothing. Shakespeare's not on the nose like that. People talk around things all the time. They say the opposite of what they mean. We were talking about this in class, about irony and how we know, how you interpret. How do you know when someone says, nice shirt, that they don't like your shirt? How do you know? How do you know in print when you can't hear their voice if it just says, nice shirt? How do you know? Because we do know. We do know when someone hates our shirt and they say, nice shirt. We know that they're being really mean, and they're being mean by saying a thing that means the opposite of what it says. We know that, to me, is much more interesting than someone walking in and going, I hate your shirt. Why? Because we get to be part of it, I guess. Because it's less interesting when people say exactly what they mean. Is this so obvious to everybody? I hope so, because it's obvious to me, and yet I just read a whole novel written by a brilliant author who is actually extremely good at writing, such that I see every part of it. I feel every part of it. She gets across the excitement and the fear and the danger and the hope and all of these and the loss and all of these things. But it's just in the service of, it's in the service of things that don't mean more than what they are. And it's just so flat. It's so flat. And I get mad. I get mad a lot. I was reading the Furniture Bible today, as one does, chapter and verse, and saw this one particular kind of like Provençal kind of like whitish stain on yellowish, goldish, orangish wood with white and blue. And I was like, oh, I hate it. I got so mad at it. I hated it so much. I got mad at it. When I got to the pages on gilding, I was like, I hate this. And I like whipped past it quick. So I didn't have to look at the gilding because I hate gilding. I don't know what my issue is with gilding or with that weird whitish. Oh, I hate it. You know how they make dressers like that where it's, I hate visible, intentional distressing. Stop distressing the dresser, sir. Sir, you're distressing the dresser. Like, quit it. It's distressed now. Also, it's just ugly. It's ugly, and I hate it. I want everything to be a smooth, shiny mahogany, don't I? That's silly, but it's true. I do love mahogany. Plus, I love the Furniture Bible for so many reasons. It's not just what you see is what you get. The guy is very funny. He goes into this long explanation of French polish, which takes like an hour, and you have to do this thing, all these special steps in all these special ways, and it's really easy to do it wrong. And he says, I wonder if I can find it. Hold the phone one moment while I find this quote. Oh, there's a picture of the horrible finish. Ew, I hate it. Here's what he says. You will invariably fail at this process, but it is the only way to learn. Your pad will be too wet and melt the finish. Your pad will be too dry and scratch it. Your pressure will be too light and you will not remove any oil. Your pressure will be too strong and you will imprint your moves onto the finish. Dot, dot, dot. Or all of the above. Take heart. Practice makes perfect. Ah, I like him. See, that's like not just about furniture, but life. I like when furniture advice is life advice. He doesn't just go straight at it. He comes at it with a little twist, a little flavor, a little flair, a little personality. And maybe that's what I'm missing. I want the personality. And also, I feel like the author ultimately is way too forgiving of the main character for all of her privilege. And this is what why I was like, stop looking at me. Hi, kitty. Because this definitely happens in things I write where these characters are beset by animals who are yelling. Like Harriet is this way for sure. She has too much privilege and she doesn't know it, which is the way of privilege. You don't see it. But once you realize it, you have to be like, okay, I get it. I own it. I was privileged. I get it. Like there's a whole fight she has with Isaiah, I think in a McDonald's or somewhere, where she's like, well, I've never been to fast food. And he's like, okay, how? How did you grow up? And she's like, well, I couldn't drive and I had no way to get anywhere. And I, you know, nobody ever took me to fast food. I just never grew up with fast food. And he's like, you got to admit you're privileged. He says things that are kind of horrible, like that she's a princess and all this. She's like, well, I don't think so, but I guess I can see what you mean. You know, I grew up starving and whatnot, but like, sure. Okay. He's like starving in a mansion. She's like, okay, yes, starving in a mansion. Starving and freezing in a mansion. Is that good enough for you? So there's this whole weird thing about privilege, which is very hard to grapple with because it's something people aren't inherently aware of in themselves. And so when they become aware of it, it can be very embarrassing all around. Like nobody wants to see anybody have these socioeconomic self-revelatory awareness awakenings in front of everybody else. Like, okay, go to therapy or whatever, but like I don't necessarily need to hear about it. But it is something that had to come up in that book, Thousand Leaving Thrushcross, and it's something that never gets addressed here. Never. Like a little tiny bit where she's literally hanging out with these kids who are functionally homeless. and being sad about losing her castle. Like, she never gets to an awareness of what that means to these people or what it looks like or how it feels to be around someone who's like, well, I want to see you, so I'm going to borrow my mom's car and come get you. Her fancy little red sports car. Right? Like, it's so privileged, and it's unconsidered privilege is really ugly. And having a character with unconsidered privilege never really grasping it is not attractive. And this is a character we like. We intrinsically like her before we start the book because she's in this other book. And I'm not naming any names, so I don't know. If you're a sleuth, you can figure it out. But she's unconsidered. And it's just very odd to read that and wonder, like, is the author unaware of how that looks? Like, I wrote Harriet, and I did not grow up like Harriet. I did not grow up in a mansion. I grew up in small houses or old houses or, you know, but they were houses. They weren't apartments. So there's that. But, like, you know, I was lucky I finally got my own room when I was, going into seventh grade because we moved. But, like, and that is a privilege compared to a lot of people, but it's not a privilege compared to a lot of people also, right? I'm the famous, like, American middle class who everyone thinks they're middle class, but I think I might be middle class. So, I don't know where all these mansions are coming from. And this book really made me consider, why does everybody live in a big house? They don't. Like, in The Nerve, Ariel The Nerve does not. She's in a dorm, and then she rents a house, and then it's fine. But, like, Harriet's always in a frickin' mansion. And it's weird. It's weird. Harriet and houses. Like, houses in general are fascinating to me in fiction. Because they could be anything, but we pick what they are. And once we pick what they are, they mean something. They don't just mean nothing. Oh, I want to read all the castle books. By which I mean, we have always lived in the castle. I capture the castle. And what's the third one? Oh, I was going to write the third one. Castle full of trees. I want to read the other two, though. Oh, because these houses in those books are amazing. Amazing. We have always lived in the castle is fantastic for houses. And I don't know, like, you can't throw somebody in a giant mansion or a castle and not have it mean anything. It means something. She's in the library of this castle, and there's a pearl that's down between the floorboards that the traveler girl shows her because that girl knows where it is and our girl doesn't. Isn't that funny? And it's her own place where she grew up. But that girl grew up there too. She hung out with the grandfather the whole time our girl was away at school. This girl was over there learning archaeology and geology and sedimentation and all these things. She's the one who knows about the Bronze Age, right? And so she knows where the pearl is in between the floorboards, and they can't get it out, which is absurd to me because, yes, you can get some tweezers, get it out, get a knitting needle. If it got down there, you can get it out. But the whole thing is, this is like a conceit of the book is like, you can't get it out. You can't always take it with you. You can't fix the thing that's broken, etc. But it's just, she doesn't seem to be aware of any of that. And I find that a very unattractive trait in a character, even a character who, as I said, I pre-adore this character, like screamed about what happened to her. So now you know which one it was. She's just so clueless. It kind of made me not like her. And being 15 or 16 is not an excuse when people are telling it to you. If you don't know, you don't know. But if somebody says it to you and you still don't know, then that's on you. That's I was just saying this to somebody Friday, like a student once said to me, just because you told me doesn't mean I know. But like, it kind of does. You've been told you should know. And it's true. It takes us some time, but she never gets there. She never, ever, ever gets there. It's so problematic to me. So how would I redo it? I wouldn't want to tackle this rewrite. This is a monster and it's already published and everything. And I didn't write it, but like, I would have her have an arc. Like, maybe she doesn't like them to start off with and then she figures it out. That's a story. Not like, oh, I somehow overcame all of the prejudices of everybody around me, so I'm already perfect. And then we go through our exchanges of information and our fun and we get to know each other and you guys come to accept me. Like, is that their job, that these travelers have to be accepting of the rich girl. That's the arc. That's an ugly arc. That's not a good arc. I made the poor homeless people like me, even though I'm rich. Like, really? I'm just suddenly remembering Cole, who's also homeless. But Harriet gives her a home. She gives her like four homes in a row. She gives her the guest house. She said, come live with us. We have a spare bed. And Cole does. She gives her a home. And then they move up to the grandparents' house. And that's a second home. And then she goes and lives in Uncle Harry's house. That's the third home. And then her parents kick her out. And she goes and lives in the carriage house. That's the fourth home. And then they go in the stables, which has been converted to apartments. And that's the fifth home. She gives her so many homes. Homes for Cole. That's like the whole theme of everything I write is homes for Cole. Cole is much more on my level than Harriet. Cole is like diffident, doesn't trust that anything's going to work out. When things go bad, she's like, oh yeah, of course they're going to go bad. It's so cool. Cole, I love Cole. If you remember at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a, you've probably seen this, so I'm just going to describe it. There was a blonde girl. I think she had blonde hair and bangs and glasses, maybe yellow glasses, and a yellow and white striped sweater. And she was sitting there strumming her guitar like, dun, 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 dun. And it just like, you could tell she was coming. She looked like an elementary school teacher. And she was coming into the beginning of a song, strum me, strum me, strum. And then when she got to the place where the vocals were going to start, she just went, ah! Started screaming. And that's who I based Cole on. I wonder if I can find that. It is definitely on my phone. I like characters with depth. I like Cole. Cole has depth. She has problems in her past and she has ways of dealing with it, and she's dealt with it well and she's dealt with it badly, and she makes mistake after mistake after mistake, but she leads with her heart and she cares so much about people and she's trying to change things. She helps people around her. She's the heart of the story, I think. Like, Harriet might be the main character, but Cole's a much more interesting character. All right, what do we learn from this? Don't do it. Don't do flat scenes. Don't write on the nose scenes. Stop hitting that. Me. I'm so fidgety because I used my inhaler before I started. Yeah, don't write flat scenes. And if you go through your work and you read it and you're like, oops, these people are all saying exactly what they're thinking, and this scene is just like an outline from a book or something, and it's just like, it is what it says it is. If it's WYSIWYG, yeah, get a twist on it. Find a way to twist it. Go back to the John Rogers thing. People have to, why is Darcy's proposal so famous, right? Both of his proposals. Why are they so famous? The first one is so famous because it's so bad. He's like, you're beneath me and your mother's awful, but, and this is probably going to ruin me, but you want to marry me? He's like, I'm in love with you against my best interests and against my heart and against everything I believe in. But, you know, apparently I can't get over it. So do you want to marry me? And she's like, I wouldn't marry you if you were the last man on earth for reasons like that you've given. And she is basically indigent and needs to find a husband to take care of her family. Hi. And so that's why that's such a good proposal. If he just walks in and is like, you're awesome, I love you, marry me. That's so boring. Also, we need a reason for her to say no when it's like unheard of and she's desperate and so on. But that's why that's a famous proposal, possibly the most famous proposal. So yes, come at it like I was saying about the John Rogers thing, like deliver it with attitude. Find a reason you're mad about it. Find a reason you're psyched about a bad thing. Find a reason you're excited about something being boring. Oh, I have 4 hours to do absolutely nothing because I have to wait for this thing. Oh. Like, that's so much better than like, okay, I have 4 hours with nothing to do. No, don't do that. Don't be boring about how you tell things. And it's got to have that drive to it. Like, this whole book long, just like, I think the preaching really wrecked the book. I think the preaching was bad and harmed it because it turned every scene. Like, remember I was talking about how you go through a script or a draft it's harder with a novel, but with a script, you can go through and be like, what is this scene doing? What is this doing? I mean, you can do it with a novel. It's just usually longer than a, you know, 3/4 of a page or 2 pages or whatever. What is the function of this scene? And if you go through and the function is racists are bad, like, find a way to do that differently and make it more and make it better and make it more complex and make it layered and levels and all of these things. You got to make it better than that. We can't just do ground level, like toddler programming. And this really is the level of, like, I can't think of the shows now. Like, I keep thinking of Wubsy, but Wubsy was much more complicated than this. It was, there was some, like, these little blobby figures acting out scenarios, you know what I mean? Where, oh, I did a bad thing, and a bad thing happened. Uh-oh, I did it wrong. Oh, no. I wanted the cookie, and so I took the cookie, but I shouldn't have taken the cookie. Okay, I mean, yeah, but can we maybe twist it up a little bit? Give it the old Rogers maneuver? Give it something. Give it a twist. Give it character. Give it layers and depth and meaning that's more than just the sum of its parts. Really, we can do this. And I know this author can do it. Although, I want to read the other one now. I'm not going to. I don't want to read something that's going to make me mad. Oh, no. I started reading Doomsday Book again because that's also on my phone. And I was just like, give me something to read. And it's bothering me too. Like, there's this guy and his mom who are comic relief, and every so often they're just like, "Da-dum-boosh! Here's the comic relief, da-da-da-da-da, comic relief time, da-da-da-da-da," and then that's over, and you're like, "Ha, ah, comic relief, okay, back to the misery." And then, like, there's that in the present and in the past. And I'm just like, so I think I need to do something different for a while because I'm in some kind of over-analytical crisis moment or something. Turns out you can analyze too much. Who knew? Besides all my students. My students who are, I'm teaching how to analyze literature. Years and years ago, one said, I think you're reading too much into this. And I'm like sticking my arms up in the air, and there's never too much. You can always read more into things. But when there's things where you can't read more into it, that's when it's a problem. That's when you run into this brick wall of a book. Like, how can I can't make it mean more than it means. And you need to, you need it to be more than just like a greeting card. Happy birthday. Even greeting cards do more than this, where they're like, who could forget as nice someone as nice as you? But those are straightforward. But then there's like complicated ones where it's like, I don't know. Go look at them. I can't think of any offhand. But there's so many ways to do things, so many interesting ways. And then there's such boring ways to do things. Please, let's not be boring. Okay, I haven't written anything all week because I was on a steroid dose pack. If you've ever been on that, it makes you completely insane. I didn't sleep much for 5 days, I guess. And then it wore off and I was instantly allergic to everything in the whole world. And now I'm all Benadryl'd up, but my throat's all itchy and weird and I hate it. Hopefully getting that cured soon. So I didn't write anything. I've been thinking a lot about Becca, and I just read somebody who was on Tumblr who wrote this amazing screed about how growing up she was ADHD, but nobody ever diagnosed girls with that. And everybody just got mad at her when she would not behave the way they wanted. And so she just started like, I love her because she took it almost as a mission. She took it almost as a mission to punish the bad and reward the good. So if teachers were evil to her, and we all know teachers can be completely evil to students, they can be little fascists and tin pot dictators, we know this. People with no power and no money who have control over something will sometimes abuse that control. We know this. So if they were evil to her, she would make their lives hell. And if they were good to her, she would be wonderful. And she described like sitting in class doodling. And if they tried to confront her about it, she would give them the most evil look. And if they asked any questions, she would say, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know to whatever they asked and just be non-compliant. And I loved her so much for writing this. And it went on and on and on. And I screenshotted the whole entire thing because I want it for Becca. In the Becca book, 40 Days and 40 Nights, because Becca, see, my heroines tend to be passive, and I hate that. And then I write it, and I'm like, why won't they do anything? Oh, you wrote them passive, doy. So I'm giving that to Becca as of today, which means a huge rewrite. Yay. But what's there on the page sucks anyway already, so I have to fix it. Like, it's, that's a whole draft. Well, it's like 80,000 words or something with a lot of garbage in it, a lot of nonsense and dead ends and missing all the good stuff that needs to be there. So basically it's a draft, so that's fine. But like, I like this defiance. I like this character who's just like, I'm not going to do it. Now that does remind me of me. Like, if you are a pain to me, I will not behave for you. I won't. And I'm not going to be cooperative if you're being a jerk to my face. Why would I? Nobody should. Don't reward that. And she even says the things, she says things that I think Harriet said it somewhere. Was it Harriet? I don't know. Some of my heroines are sort of starting to meld together in my mind. Some of them actually meet, you know. There's a scene where they meet in Maeswood. Ariel and Harriet meet and hang out and become friends, play the flute, paint pictures, play the cello. Anyway, she says things like, I've just been invisible. I wanted to be invisible because when they were ignoring me, I wasn't getting bad attention, which is, it's common when you're in a less than ideal environment, like you'd learn to turn invisible so that people don't mess with you. Fine. But then she learns, she never quite learns, but this character learns and Becca learns that that's not enough. It's not enough just to be self-effacing and hide out from people who are being jerks to you. No, go on the offensive, punish them for being jerks and reward them for being good. And I think that's kind of lovely. I wonder if I should read some of that. She was, this thing was just, it blew my mind when I read it. And yeah, I've been reading the Furniture Bible in Tumblr. Let's see if I can find it. Oh, I forgot about the candles. Okay, there's also the candle thing. Oh, the candle thing I saw today. The Yankee Candles, Stages of Abstraction by Alex McMillan. Undeniably Alex. I mean, at Undeniably Alex. I'm not sure what platform that is. Might be Blue Sky. I don't know. I couldn't find him on Blue Sky and I couldn't find him on Tumblr. I wanted to go ask for permission, but I couldn't find him. Anyway, Yankee Candle's Stages of Abstraction absolutely applies to, and I will come back to the Defiant Girl, absolutely applies to the layers in the What You See Is What You Get universe, okay? And I'll just stick these on the blog. Level one, the scent represents a physical object where the object's aroma is one of its distinct properties. Example, black cherry. Level two, the scent represents a physical object in a specific state where the aroma represented is not necessarily that of the object, but rather representative of that object's state. In this case, the cleanness is the smell, not the cotton, and the candle is clean cotton. Level three, the candle is cliffside sunrise. The scent represents a location or event where the aroma is supposed to be reminiscent of an intrinsic property held by a collective of objects, where that property doesn't necessarily affect the collective's aroma. This guy's so smart. Level four, autumn sunset. The scent represents an event with an intrinsic property. This temporal aroma is devoid of location or physical property, but a shared idea of the property is still understood. And it goes on and on and on. Okay, I think there's nine levels, something like that. Level five is sunny daydream. You can see how they're getting more abstract. The scent represents a fully personal experience with some unrelated property. The experience itself has no aroma or shared understanding. To six, seven. Oh, and then Omega is the last one. Level Omega is called, the candle is sweet nothings. The scent represents a property detached from any object. The absence of an object is in fact part of the scent. Total abstraction. So I skipped two because I don't want to read to you all day, but this is what I'm talking about with the what you see is what you get. Like, if it's a black cherry candle and it smells like black cherries, you're like, that's a black cherry candle, smells like black cherries, representation and nothing more, right? And fiction cannot be on that level or it is bad. It has to have the other layers of candle to it. It has to be about more than just the facts on the page and just telling us the facts on the page, or it's so bad. And that is what was so offensive to me on a deep level about this book I just read, that rather than going levels up where it's fiction and it's about something and it's interesting and there's chewy, twisty goodness in it. No, it was just like, here's the thing. Thing is good. Here's the thing. Thing is bad. Why? I guess that might be level 2 on the candle scale, but it never gets beyond that. It never gets anywhere. It just doesn't, it never gets off the ground. And it's so weird that such a good writer can do this. But I know there's no such thing as good and bad writers. There's just writers who write good books and writers who write, you know, the other kind of books. The other kind that aren't. Oh dear. Well, I have a stack of the ones that aren't to work on and make them into the kind that are. So maybe I should go get on that and stop yelling about this book. If you do want to know which book it was and you want to email me and ask, I will tell you or confirm your guess. I wish it was better. I wish it went and said something about the things. I wish it was more. I wish it grappled with privilege. I wish it grappled. How can you write a whole book about a rich girl befriending and her brother befriending these travelers and fighting for justice with them without ever grappling with privilege in any meaningful way or saying anything about privilege in any meaningful way? How can you do that? They own all this land. Give them some. I mean, would that be a step? Yes. Man. There's even an object. There's a little reliquary, which is a cup-shaped reliquary. It's not what a reliquary actually usually looks like, but it's a little black wooden cup with silver binding. It's bound in silver or whatever, carved. And it was given from the traveler people to this family like 700 years ago or 200, well, I don't know, hundreds of years ago, full of pearls. And in return, they got undisputed use of this river and the willow, you know, the riverbank and the willows because they're basket makers. And it was their payment for this. And then when they sell the house, they get nothing. They don't get it back. They don't get anything. They lose the use of that bank. They lose their camping place. They lose everything. They don't get it. They don't get it back. Rich people, you could have maybe done something about that. You could have just like not taken away their entire way of earning money without restitution when they paid for it. Like, and it's just like that the whole time. It makes me crazy, this book. Like, how did you not give them something back? How did you not refund them their payment? Like, I thought they were going to get the cup, but nope. It just had to go with the sale of the estate. Why? Why did it have to go with that? It didn't. It did not. It didn't. It's not like it was all repossessed or something. They were just selling it. Well, they could have not sold that thing and given it to those people. Like, I don't. They could have sold it to a museum and they could have had a bunch of money. You know, the traveler people with the kids. Like, ugh. And it never gets resolved and none of the money. And maybe it's just awkwardness about money. And I know people are weird about money and it's hard to talk about money. But like, poverty is a thing. And you know what a really good cure for poverty is? Money. I shouldn't have to say that. See, I delivered it with attitude, though. Yay, John Rogers. Maybe I'll go listen to some Leverage commentaries and calm down. I mean, that is all about economic disparity and people abusing their money and power. Okay. Yep. All right. Well, I'm baking some rolls that are part chickpea flour, so we'll see how that comes out. I'm waiting to hear about a thing that hopefully will happen because it would be awesome. We don't know. I'm in limbo. I'm coming off my crazy steroids, so I've really been beaten up by the pharmaceutical industry this week in good ways, but now it's really kicking back on me. What else is going on with you? I've been such a pudding brain that rather than write anything, because I was like, oh, I'm going to be awake for a week. I'm going to write everything. I wrote nothing. I stopped taking my laptop upstairs with me. I couldn't do anything. It was just like staring into a bright light the whole week long. Yep, pretty bad. So I didn't do a thing, and now those things are undone, and a week has passed where I haven't touched any of my writing, and that's not great because, boy, do you forget fast. Ugh. But this week, hopefully, we're getting like another 20 inches of snow this week, which isn't that much. Oh, I fixed the snowblower. I'm very proud of that. Competence. Love it. I poured some dry gas in it. It wasn't that complicated. And then I had to take it apart and get all this mouse nest out of it. But still, I'm pretty proud of that because I fought it and I won with science and a screwdriver. Yay, science and screwdrivers. What else is going on with you guys? I have nothing going on, really. That's a lie. I have a ton going on. It's all really big, but I can't really talk about it. Hopefully it's life-changing for the awesome, right? We can only hope. All right, I'm going to go work on writing, I hope. I took the last of the pills today. Hopefully I'll be back to some kind of equilibrium. Anyway, I hope you're reading good things. Tell me what they are. I hope you're writing good things. Tell me what they are. Send me an email at sacredcheesepodcast@gmail.com and I will read it and I will respond. And maybe I'll even read the things you suggest, because sometimes I read things and I'm like, why are you reading that? You don't like this book. But at least I read it again and figured out what bugged the crap out of me the first time I read it. The first time I read it, I was just like, ew. Like, seriously, I kept reading. I'm like, do you know what I mean? Like when a writer puts their fetish into their fiction and you're like, dude, this is not as universal as you think it is. This is not just a plot point. This is you being weird about something. Maybe quit it. Sheesh, this book. Have you read it? If you've read it, please tell me. And if you're able to love things unconditionally without analyzing the hell out of them, let me know how you do that, because sometimes I think I wish I could turn it off, but I can't. There's my student again. You're reading too much into this. I'm not, I swear. It's my job. All right. Hopefully we're writing good things. Let's write some more books and have that thing I talked about last week. That was a ping pong ball I just knocked off the table. Oh, you should see the waveform. It is so cool. Yeah, the thing I talked about last week, being objective. So like catching yourself in what you're doing, looking at what you're doing honestly and clearly and being aware, being that cool and distant and self-aware about what you're doing in your fiction, that you can fix things when they're not right. Okay? It's so hard, but you can do it. We can all do it, because it just means actually looking in the mirror that you're not in, but your book is in, and seeing whether it's doing what you say it's doing, or whether you're putting things in there, like this author, for reasons that are not about the fiction. They're not about the fiction. If you're doing that, you got to stop it. It has to be about the fiction. The fiction gets to win at all times. It really is about what you make the priority, and what you make the priority always has to be storytelling, not anything else. That's what this whole episode is about, isn't it? It's about putting the storytelling first, not your preaching, however valid it may be, and however much I may agree with it, it's not the place for it. Don't put that first, put the storytelling first, and don't put your weird kink first. Put the storytelling first. It has to serve the story. It has to. I'm going to go thump the furniture Bible for emphasis. Do you think they would let me swear on the furniture Bible if I were getting sworn into something? You're allowed to swear on whatever you want. Maybe that's my holy book. You don't know. It's called a Bible. Oh, I have the Deep Space Nine Bible somewhere. I could use that. All right, let's see. What else? Anything else? No, because we've done it. We've done it all. I'm going to go do something else frantically because I'm apparently really hyped up right now. And maybe I'll snowblow with my snowblower that works. Yay, now it works. Working is good. It's a metaphor for a novel. Everything's a metaphor for a novel for me. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, though. Like, you can't just be like, my snowblower works, when your snowblower does not work. get the mouse nest out of there, get the dry gas in there, get whatever it is, fix it, get a new spark plug. I don't know, make it work. Okay, we got this, right? You got it? Send me questions, comments, concerns. You know the email, and you know, sacred cheese of life. Bye.